So you look at these interactions amongst these male baboons, and you keep track of how stable, how unstable the dyadic relationships are between these baboons with a very simple prediction. The more instability, the closer you are to that 51% versus 49, the more instability, the more stressful, the higher the glucocorticoid levels. That's not what you see. For example, you look at number 5, and if he's having a lot of unstable interactions with number 6, number 5 has a huge stress response. You look at number 5, and you look at how many unstable interactions he's having with number 4, and he's got no stress response. How could this be? Unpredictability, the same number of fights, a critical difference. If you're number 5 and you're having a lot of stressful interactions with number 6, that means number 6 is breathing down your neck and is about to toss you out and you're about to get a demotion. If you're having a lot of unstable interactions with number 4, it means you're about to supplant him, you're about to get a promotion. Number 5, instability in this direction, bad news. In that direction, great news. It's not just, in this case, the amount of instability. It's what it means. And when it means good news, you don't get as much of a stress response. So you see similar things in humans, and you can even see it under remarkable circumstances where you get interactions between the absolute reality of a stressor and how you actually interpret it. Okay, here's a possibility in a corporation. You've got this huge corporation, and there's some guy working in the mailroom getting, you know, $7 an hour or some such thing, and then you've got the CEO of the company who's getting a gazillion dollars a year. People suddenly discover that this guy in the mailroom is the greatest mailroom person on the entire planet, the most skillful one, and management comes in and says, we need to reward this. Starting tomorrow, you have a $100,000 a year salary. Meanwhile, you notice that the CEO has just done some disastrously imprudent things and practically bankrupted the company, and in a shocking, shocking exception to the usual rule, the guy's actually held responsible for this, and they say, okay, because you have screwed up royally, starting tomorrow, you have a $100,000 a year salary. You can bet the mailroom guy is not going to be going for a headhunter to find another job, and you could bet the next day the CEO is. $100,000 a year means very different things depending on which direction you're coming from. Now, where this can wind up being sort of relevant is when you see these interactions between control, predictability, outcome, interpretation, where you can even see interactions between some of these pieces, where it could be fascinating, not just in the realm of how much of a stress response you have to bad, stressful things, but remarkably what the response is in your body to great news, to wonderful things. And this is the world of somebody from out of nowhere wins the lottery, and it's great, and it's transformed their life, and it winds up being unsettling for a number of reasons. One is it totally messes up their relationships with everybody else, and the other is the sense of the randomness is very often reported by these folks as being quite unsettling. Or you can have somebody who wins the lottery in a much deeper, more important way. This is someone who is desperately in need of an organ transplant and is on the waiting list and who knows, and the clock is ticking for how much longer they can survive. And suddenly, from out of nowhere, it happens. The transplant, the organ becomes available. This is wondrous. Suddenly it's there and their life is saved. And in the aftermath, amid the gratitude, the pleasure, the joy, what is also very often seen amongst these transplant individuals is a tremendous agitated sense of stress built around the lack of control. My God, if that person on the motorcycle had taken that curve 5 miles an hour slower, wouldn't have died, I'd be sitting here dying for lack of that organ. My God, if one of the other people on the donor list had a slightly better genetic match with that organ, wouldn't have been me. The sense of, I'm going to live, but I had so little control over what happened, that winds up being quite unsettling. So a world of stress and a world of psychological modulators of stress where it even plays into things that are not stressful, things that could be good news, fun news, wondrously life-saving news. So what have we gotten to at this point? We've now gone through some important modulators of the stress response from the last lecture and this one, outlets for frustration, social support, predictive information, a sense of control, interpreting things as getting better. All of those are great. And thus you need a punchline for how to live your life successfully with these factors in mind and from what you've learned here. And if you think what you've learned is as follows, it would be a disaster. If you think the rule is get as much control in your life as possible, get as much predictive information as possible, have as many outlets as possible, if you turn this into this mantra of more and more and more control and more predictability, that's not going to reduce your levels of stress. That's going to increase it in lots of ways. Because it turns out these principles don't apply all the time. They apply only with certain parameters. Only some of the time does a sense of control, does predictive information actually help. First one, predictive information. We've already gone through that scenario, which is the lab rat is getting the shocks now and then, and 10 seconds before each shock, it gets the little warning light. Great, and it's quite protective. That's wonderful. When does it not work? Now you've got the same rat, and instead of getting the warning light 10 seconds before each shock, it gets the warning light half a second before. That does no good whatsoever. How come? Because the rat doesn't have enough time to activate its coping strategy. On the other hand, suppose that you've got the warning light coming instead of 10 seconds in advance, it's coming 3.5 weeks in advance. It does no good at all either, for obvious reasons. What you wind up seeing is predictive information helps only within a certain time span. When it's not too far in advance, when there's enough time to plan your coping strategy and have it far enough in advance when it's a really major stressor, and not only doesn't it protect, it makes things worse. Just imagine if you have this omnipotent voice that suddenly comes in and gives you some predictive information saying 3 years, 27 days, and 4 hours from now, you're going to have a horrible accident and your leg is going to be amputated. Oh, I feel great having gotten all this predictive information. If it's far enough in advance, not only doesn't it protect, it can make things worse. Next realm where it may not work very well. Next realm, and again, this has to do with predictive information, and the point is, what is it predicting? What is the nature of the predictive stressor that is now being considered by you? Here's two scenarios. Here's the first one, this very odd one, where this voice, again, this omnipotent voice, comes in and suddenly says, oh my God, I just heard that yesterday there was this disaster, this meteor hit Earth, and in the process hit your backyard and took out all your flamingos. But you know what? I've got some predictive information for you. It's never going to happen again. Oh, that's wonderful. At least I know now in the aftermath of that disaster, I don't have to worry. Predictive information there doesn't do you any good whatsoever because it's predictive information about a stressor that is such a low probability that the predictive information doesn't help. You're not worrying about it happening anyway. Or you can have the converse. You can now have the omnipotent voice in some other sort of scenario. And now what it is the voice comes in and says, remember driving into work today, how awful the traffic was? I've got predictive information. It's going to be awful tomorrow also. Whoa, all that predictive information, I feel wonderful now. That doesn't help in the slightest because that is such a common stressor that you already take it for granted. So predictive information helps only for stressors with a moderate likelihood of occurring. If it is such a rare stressor that you don't even worry about it, it doesn't help. If it's such a common stressor that you take it for granted, it doesn't help. And you can even have predictive information where it does no good whatsoever when it's even giving you predictive news about something good. Okay, omnipotent voice again, saying, you know how you drove to work today and there was horrible traffic? Well, 3 months and 4 days from now, when you drive to work, there's going to be no traffic whatsoever. The police are going to pull you over and insist you share their donuts with them. Oh, that's wonderful. This does not count as useful predictive information, even in the face of it carrying good news. So predictability helps only some of the time, and very importantly, what we saw was if it's far enough in advance of the stressor, it could actually make things worse. How about control? How about a sense of control? The easy solution from the control section is have as much of a sense of control as often as possible and just magnify it and control, 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 and I'm the master of my fate and you need to think that way all the time. Absolutely not. A sense of control can be a disaster at times. Some of the most compassionate things we ever do is to try to decrease somebody's sense of control. Nobody could have stopped the car in time the way that little girl darted out. It doesn't matter if you had gotten Dad to the doctor sooner, it was an incurable disease. There's nothing you could have done about it. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. You didn't have any control. And some of the worst things that we ever do societally is magnify somebody's sense of control. Oh, what does she expect if she's going to dress like that, walking around a bad part of town? Oh, what do you expect if they refuse to assimilate into society? Of course people are going to turn against them. One of the worst versions of that in medical history concerns schizophrenia. And schizophrenia, horrible disease, has had an awful major impact for decades and decades on mental health. And of course people have wondered, what causes schizophrenia? And up to the 1950s or so, there was an absolutely clear answer given in the field, which is schizophrenia is caused by the mother. It's a certain mothering style named schizophrenogenic mothering style, and it's the mother's fault. In other words, the mother had the control to determine whether or not the child became schizophrenic. You know, as the years went by, it was viewed as this was a little harsh, and a more compassionate version of this theory came in, which was they allowed the possibility that it was the father who screwed up parents' parenting style as the cause of schizophrenia. And then in the 1950s, there was a revolution. People discovered some of the first drugs, the antipsychotics, that could control schizophrenia. And this shockwave went through the psychiatric community. Oh my God, it's got nothing to do with parenting style. It's a biochemical disorder. And schizophrenogenic mothering went down the tube overnight, and you could see amazing editorials in some of those journals, the pain some of these healthcare professionals felt when realizing what they had done by inflating a sense of control. They would write editorials like, I've spent my entire life battling this nightmare of a disease. I have tried to do good. I have tried to help. I've done the best I could do with the information available as to what causes this disease, this mothering style idea. My God, the damage I have done over the years. We see this pattern here. You can, in some cases, be wildly compassionate, wildly stress-reducing by decreasing somebody's sense of control. And some of the most awful, stressful things you can ever do to someone could be increasing their sense. How do you get some rules coming out of this? And basically what you see is as follows. In the face of stressors that are mild to moderate in severity, you want to increase somebody's feeling of control, whether it's realistic or not. You want them to feel like they were in control, because what you're biasing the person to do then, to feel, is to think just how bad it would have been if I hadn't had a sense of control. It feels great. It builds up a sense of efficacy. When do you not want to inflate the sense of control in the face of horrible, disastrous stressors? Because all you're doing is setting somebody up with the sense of control to think, oh my God, I could have made it so much better and I didn't. Sense of control works for only mild to moderate stressors. And you can see how powerful these variables are in terms of that. Also lurking in there is a remarkable sort of realization. One of the great sort of golden rules of psychiatry, of mental health professionals, is that truth and beauty and mental health go hand in hand. What you're seeing here is, in some circumstances, the most compassionate thing you can do is disabuse somebody of a notion that is actually for real, to decrease the sense of control. So what have we gotten to here? We now see the enormous power of these psychological variables, a sense of control, a sense of predictability, outlets for frustration, social support, and a view of things getting better. And what we've also seen is, amid these being enormously powerful, they don't work all the time. They work only within certain parameters, and get outside those parameters and you make things worse. What this has set us up for now is moving past our world of all those preceding lectures of inflammation in your blood vessels and decreased numbers of receptors on your pituitary. And what this transitions us to is the trenches of the interaction between stress and mental health. What does stress have to do with clinical depression?
Lecture 19, Stress and the Biology of Depression.
Al, at some point you have to admit there's some very cool, bizarre diseases out there. There's all sorts of exotic ones that are, on a certain level, just irresistible. There's Elephant Man Syndrome. There's multiple personality disorders. They're the sort of diseases that, you know, get turned into the movie of the week. There's this really bizarre one, a disease called Kuru, which is only found amongst cannibals in the New Guinea Highlands, and it produces a disease a little bit like mad cow disease, and it is transmitted by eating the brains of somebody. And these are cool, bizarre ways in which biology can go wrong. If you want uncool, unbizarre, meat and potatoes disease versions of just profound human sadness, there's nothing out there like a major clinical depression. Depression. As we transition here, slowly over the recent lectures, moving from the world of your heart, your liver, your kidney, now moving into the realm instead of your psyche, your psychiatric status, we've been making this transition, beginning in the last few lectures, to see what does psychological stress comprise and how powerful can it be. This is a clear transition to what we will focus on in this lecture, the starts of psychiatric disorders, ones that are absolutely deeply intertwined with depression. Now, depression, it's going to be two lectures worth of material to cover, and this is for a number of reasons. First off, complicated subject, and there's actually an awful lot known about the biology of depression. Second reason, that there are oceans of people out there with major depression. Current estimates by the World Health Organization is that depression is the number four leading cause of disability on this planet, and the estimates are by the year 2020 that it's going to be up to number two, following things like metabolic syndrome, those disorders we know about by now. So complicated, so it takes a lot of time, incredibly prevalent, so it's really worth going into. And another reason why it's really worth going into, it is a disaster of a disease. And I will make the argument in here that a major depression is among the worst diseases anybody could possibly suffer. And we'll see why I think that. Okay, what we'll be doing in this lecture is starting off in one domain of understanding depression, understanding the biology of depression. And after an initial part of focusing on what the symptoms of depression are, some of which are absolutely intuitively obvious and some of which are quite surprising, after that introductory stretch, we will begin to focus on what is the biology of depression, what is the brain chemistry, What's the brain chemistry that goes wrong? What are the structural features of major depressive brains which wind up being abnormal? Transitioning into the next lecture, what hormones are out of whack? What do hormones have to do with depression, perhaps even nutrition? At that point, what you will have is everything needed to be a cutting-edge biological psychiatry maven. You'll know about hormones, neurochemistry, and neuroanatomy. And what we will see at that point is, if that's all you know about the subject, you don't have a prayer of being able to do a whole lot to contain depression. What we'll transition to at that point is the other half of the equation. What are psychological factors, and how are they part of the whole process of clinical depression? And what you're going to see there is what seems to be at the end two completely different worlds, different languages, the world of depression as funny neurochemicals and hormone ratios, the world of depression as problems with a sense of control, a sense of despair. What we're going to see is the way these two very different views are pulled together is by recognizing the absolutely essential role of stress. Now, what will run through all of this and is implicit in, you know, the very subject of this lecture, the biology of depression, winds up being one of the things that is challenging when dealing with depression, which is there's a weird sort of moralistic thread that runs through how people think of depression, where it's almost a sense of, well, hey, we all get depressed. Bad things happen. We get depressed. We feel lousy. And we come out the other end. Depression is this disease of people who don't quite pull it together, who kind of indulge themselves. There's a weird tinge of sort of moralistic judgment about it. Depression. What will be a main theme ultimately in this and the next lecture is depression is a disease. It is a disease. It is real of a disease, as is diabetes. And you don't sit down a juvenile diabetic and say, oh, what's the deal with this insulin stuff? Stop babying yourself. This is a real disease. So we start off by looking at what depression looks like. And we start off immediately with a semantic problem, which is we use the word depression, again, in an everyday sense. Oh, something disappointing occurs, something that sort of gets you down. You get depressed. Oh, I've been feeling depressed, it was a depressing day, that sort of thing. When talking about a major clinical depression, this is not, oh, feeling kind of down. This is a disorder where you are so crushed by the sense of depressiveness that you can't get out of bed, that you don't, you know, do laundry for months on end, that your entire life is ruined, you can't get out of your house, you can't function, you can't work, you don't see anyone. It is a disease that absolutely cripples you. So what are the symptoms of major depression? As I said before, I think major depression is among the worst diseases that can possibly happen to you. And it's because of this main symptom. Think about a remarkable feature of humans. You get somebody with a nightmare of a disease, with cancer, terminal cancer, and to a surprising extent, people will wind up saying things like, you know, obviously I didn't want this disease and don't want to die, but it wasn't until I got the cancer that I realized how important family is to me, or what good friends I have, or I found my God, or, and I almost feel grateful for it. We humans have this bizarre ability to find pleasure in the most unlikely places. And the defining symptom of depression is it's a biochemical, genetic, environmental disorder where you can't appreciate sunsets, where you lose the capacity to feel pleasure. This is the core symptom, anhedonia. Hedonism, the pursuit of pleasure, anhedonia, the inability to feel it. So, moving on and getting a sense here of the sheer severity of depression. Along with that lack of pleasure, the anhedonia, there is deep grief, deep guilt. And this, again, is not like everyday depression. Ooh, you feel kind of down about something. You sort of grieve about something going wrong, some transient failure. When we're depressed in the everyday sense, we tend to obsess over things in the past that we feel guilty about. Again, this is not what major depression is about. It is such severe in the elements of grief and guilt that at an extreme, it could even take on a delusional quality. This is not delusional in the way a schizophrenic might be, but it's delusional in the sense of how you interpret the world around you. Let me give you an example. Older guy, perfectly healthy, and one day from out of nowhere he has a heart attack. He's in the hospital, he's recovering from it. The reality is that he is going to recover and his life can pretty much get back to normal, but he falls into a major depression as a result. So he's in there every day, getting a little bit stronger, and every day talking about how he's falling apart, he's declining, he's going to die, there's no hope for me. It happens, the hospital is circular, and the nurses get him up, and as he begins to get some strength back, he's able to walk one loop around the hospital. That's great. The next day, getting stronger, he walks two loops around. That evening, his family is there, and he's going on yet again about, oh, I'm dying, I wish you could at least tell me the truth, I'm falling. And they'll say, you're just depressed. You're getting better. Look, we heard from the nurses. Today you did two loops around the hospital, and yesterday you did one. And he'll say, no, you don't understand. They've been doing construction here at the hospital, and they had to close down the main corridor, and they had to make a new shorter one, a little one last night. So two loops around that is, in fact, a lot shorter than the big one, and I'm falling apart and I'm dying. This is delusional thought. And this was actually an engineer, the father of a friend of mine, an engineer going on about angles and diameters and radii and expecting them to believe that last night the folks came into the hospital like little beavers dug out. This is delusional thinking. And it's sufficiently so that there is this view, the typical view, that depression is a disease of emotion. Ultimately, it's also a disease of distorted cognition. You view the world around you and you so intensely see the glasses as half empty, even the ones brimming over the top, that there's ultimately a cognitively distortive, even delusional quality to it. What are some of the other symptoms of depression? Of course, the one that is among the most horrifying is the tendency of people, when highly depressed, to injure themselves, to mutilate themselves, to attempt suicide, to succeed at committing suicide. And it happens with a very high rate. The current numbers are about 15% of people will come down with a major clinical depression at some point in their lives, and a substantial subset of those people will be depressed enough at various points to feel suicidal. Not good. This is horrifying on a certain level. What's the self-injury about? It begins to tap into a subject we'll hear about later when we begin to look at the psychology of depression and a notion that depression has something to do with unresolved angers. We're going to see about that. There's some pluses and minuses to this one, but there's a soundbite that came out of that literature. Depression is anger turned inward. And the self-injury component of that certainly makes sense. What else goes wrong with a major depressive? You have social withdrawal. That's an obvious extension of the anhedonia, loss of libido, an obvious extension as well. But then you get a whole bunch of symptoms that are fascinating, a whole bunch of changes in the body of a depressive. These symptoms that are collectively called vegetative symptoms. For example, sleep changes during a depression. What's your guess? Well, you know, when most of us are kind of feeling depressed for some period, we tend to sleep more, we're just without energy. And no, people who are clinically depressed, majorly so, the tendency is to sleep less. Okay, they're depressed, they have trouble falling asleep. No, the tendency instead is to fall asleep fairly normally, but wake up really early in the morning. Wake up at 4 a.m. and you are awake and you are not remotely rested and that's it. And come into an emergency room someday with a deep incapacitating depression, and one of the things they better ask you is, so do you wake up early in the morning, early morning wakening? That is a real clear marker of the disease. Next, when you actually do fall asleep, We've learned already from the previous lecture, there's a whole structure and whole architecture to sleep, the different sleep stages, slow wave sleep, REM sleep. It tends to be about 90-minute cycles. You look at the brains of depressives when they're sleeping, and the structure, the very architecture of their sleep patterns is disorganized. Indulging yourself, absolutely no way. This is someone who, when they're asleep, their brain is working differently. More abnormalities, a change in appetite, and most people decreased, and a subset of people increased, a change in all sorts of aspects of metabolism, and for our purposes, probably the most interesting thing in a substantial percentage of depressives, increased levels of glucocorticoids. And what that screams to you is stress, and as we'll see, that makes perfect sense, and what that screams to you, I hope, is this is a biological disorder. There's hormones that are out of whack, sleep cycles. This is not stop indulging yourself. Now, another feature of depression also screams biology. And this is the fact that there's patterns to when people have their depressions. There will be a person with a cycle of being symptom-free for a certain amount of time, fall into a deep depression, come out the other end at a certain schedule. There can be rhythmicity to the disease. And the most striking example of that is people who get depressed, more likely, at only a certain time of year. And it tends to be the winter months. This is someone who, in July, things are going perfectly fine, and then something disastrous occurs, and they feel depressed, and they come out the other end, they cope, they heal, and along comes January, where there is nothing wrong whatsoever, and just like the previous six Januaries, they fall into a winter depression, and they have to be hospitalized, and there's this rhythmicity. This particular one is referred to as a seasonal affective disorder, affect, emotion, seasonal affective disorder, sad. And this is another thing that screams biology, the biology of rhythms, daily rhythms, seasonal rhythms, and there's something wrong with those rhythms. This is not, ooh, stop babying yourself. This is a disease that's all about biology. So this transitions us now to asking, what is wrong biologically in depression? And where we start off is brain chemistry. What's going on normally? And what's going on that's not quite normal in the brains of people with depression? Now, this is best covered in a diagram, which you could find in the guidebook. And this is one that shows the basic flow of information between two neurons, two brain cells. Now, you'll remember from the earlier lectures, one neuron will send a projection, a cable to another neuron, and that's what was going on in the spinal cord, the fast acute pain, the chronic pain, all of that. In actuality, that projection from one neuron to the next doesn't actually touch the next neuron. There's a little space in between called a synapse. Synapse, that's what a synapse is. It's a tiny space between two neurons. And what that means then is if a neuron is going to talk to the next neuron, it releases a chemical messenger which goes floating across the synapse. It comes out of this end of the neuron. It comes out of the extreme end of the neuron, what's called the axon terminal, and it floats across this tiny distance to what's called the dendrites of the next neuron, goes across, and yes, indeed, as we know by now, that neurotransmitter will interact with its neurotransmitter receptor, and suddenly something or other changes in that second neuron. The two neurons have talked to each other. Something or other, as we saw in the pain lecture, something or other sometimes could make the form of making the second neuron more excitable, sometimes less excitable. The neurons are talking to each other by way of these neurochemicals, neurotransmitters. Now, looking at that, there's one additional piece that you have to make sense of, which is the first neuron has released these neurotransmitters across the synapse. They bind to the receptor, they do their thing there, and they come floating off the receptor. And then, you know, you got to clean up after yourself. You've got to finish what you've done. You've got to get rid of the neurotransmitter you released, and it's floating around now. And there's two options. You could be ecologically minded. You can recycle your neurotransmitter. It is taken up by by a fancy pump in that axon, the end of the neuron that released it. It's taken back up. It's repackaged, ready to be used again. Or you can really be unecologically minded. You can throw out your neurotransmitter. There might be some enzyme in the synapse that takes the neurotransmitter, rips it into a lot of little pieces, flushes it down the toilet into your cerebral spinal fluid and such. So we've got this general role of neurochemical communication, which is a neuron, when excited, releases a neurotransmitter, floats across the synapse, stimulates the next neuron by way of binding to its receptor, comes floating off, at which point you finish the whole thing, either degrading the neurotransmitter or recycling it. So this is the general rule about neurotransmitters. And amid these general rules, there's a gazillion different chemicals that appear to be neurotransmitters that meet at least some of the criteria for them. And what we now know, and what was sort of the first bit of information in the depression field, is there's something screwy with a neurotransmitter called norepinephrine. Wait a second. I've heard the name norepinephrine before. Oh, so many lectures ago, that sympathetic nervous system releasing epinephrine, norepinephrine down at your heart. This is norepinephrine in a different part of your nervous system doing something completely different that has something to do with depression. You can use the same letter in all sorts of different words. You can use the same chemical messenger. So there's something wrong with norepinephrine in a part of the brain that has something to do with pleasure. And the absence of norepinephrine gets you into trouble there. Stay tuned, we'll see that area in a bit. So what's the evidence that there's something wrong with norepinephrine? You go back to the very first drug that was developed as an antidepressant. It's called an MAO inhibitor. Do not worry, this MAO inhibitor, the name will make sense. In the synapse, there's an enzyme which rips up norepinephrine into little pieces, it degrades it, that whole thing you just heard about, called MAO, monoamine oxidase. MAO, and what does an MAO inhibitor do? It inhibits MAO. And as a result, you don't rip up the norepinephrine afterward. It sticks around longer, and it's got nothing else to do. So it might as well hit that receptor on the next neuron a second time, and a fifth time, and a 20th time. And what happens then is you are sending more norepinephrine signaling. And depressives tend to get less depressed at that point. So what's your hypothesis at that point? What does it have to be? Ooh, if throwing in a drug that increases norepinephrine signaling makes depressions less depressive, maybe the initial problem is a paucity of norepinephrine. And this gave rise to the norepinephrine hypothesis that there's a shortage of norepinephrine in one relevant area of the brain as the cause of depression. More evidence rolled in. By the 1960s, 1970s, a next class of antidepressant drugs had become popular called tricyclic antidepressants. And it turns out they do essentially the same exact thing. They don't work on MAO, which rips up the norepinephrine. Remember that other step where you can also recycle it? The first neuron takes it back up and repackages it. What do tricyclics do? They block the reuptake. They block the reuptake, and thus the norepinephrine sticks around in the synapse longer, and for lack of anything else to do, hits the receptor a second, fourth, a 50th time, and the person gets better. Ooh, yet another way of increasing norepinephrine signaling, and depressions get less depressive. I bet there was too little norepinephrine. More evidence, there's a drug, it's used very rarely now, but there's a drug that lowers blood pressure called reserpine. And what does reserpine do? It destroys some of the packages of norepinephrine at the ends of neurons, those axons. Neurons release a lot less norepinephrine. Back to the sympathetic nervous system, less norepinephrine on the scene. Blood pressure is going to decrease. That's great. But there's the side effect, which is if you get the levels too high of this reserpine and you wipe out too much norepinephrine, the person gets clinically depressed. So we've got bidirectional evidence here. Take drugs that push up norepinephrine levels, and you take depressives and they get better. Take drugs that drive down norepinephrine levels, and you take undepressed people and they get depressed. So yes, I'm convinced by now. So what does a shortage of norepinephrine cause in the brain? Or flip the other way, what does norepinephrine normally do? And amid its roles, all sorts of things, You've got a very interesting role for norepinephrine. It's got something to do with pleasure. Back in the 50s, researchers, neuroscientists, discovered something very interesting. They found this one area of the brain, in the limbic system, where if you put an electrode down in there in a rat's brain, and here's what you did, you set things up so the rat could press a lever a certain number of times, and by doing that, it would get buzzed in that part of the brain. And this buzzing, this stimulation of this part of the brain, caused rats to be unbelievably happy. So, of course, the question is, how can you tell when a rat's unbelievably happy? It will just press the lever over and over and over. Rats would work themselves to death in order to get stimulated in this part of the brain. And it was soon called the pleasure pathway. It's gotten more technical terms. But as soon as people saw this, of course, the question is, do you find this in humans? Do I have one? Can I get a new one? Can I get a second one? And soon, neurosurgical studies with humans in the process of going in to get out a tumor, for example, in classical neurosurgery, people would be awake. And so studies were done stimulating those areas, and it would generate a pure, absolute sense of well-being. That's great. So now what if we have? The next finding, which was that that pathway makes heavy use of norepinephrine. Aha! So you got a shortage of norepinephrine in this pathway. This pleasure pathway is not working very well. And suddenly, what if you just generated anhedonia, that defining symptom of depression? So that's great. That describes everything. That explains it. It's all about norepinephrine. Here's where the problems come in. Three reasons. First one is you throw in norepinephrine into one of these neuronal systems and it starts changing what's happening. You throw in, one of those antidepressant drugs, tricyclics, monoamine oxidase inhibitors. You throw in one of those and within minutes they're changing stuff going on in the synapse. You throw them into a depressed person and they don't start feeling better for 2 to 3 weeks. Something doesn't fit. Next problem. People soon learned that, yes, norepinephrine had a role in those pleasure pathways, but they soon discovered another neurotransmitter played a much more critical role, dopamine. And then came along the drug that really messed things up, a drug like Prozac. Prozac, which is an SSRI, a serotonin, a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. This one works just like the tricyclics. It makes it impossible to take back up the neurotransmitter, but it was a different neurotransmitter, serotonin. And suddenly, the norepinephrine hypothesis wasn't looking all that exciting and very flawed there, and people punching it out. And you want a resolution at this point, a very, very simplistic one, in terms of what's going on with norepinephrine, serotonin, and dopamine during depression. Here's an extremely, extremely simplified one, and don't hold me to this. Norepinephrine has something to do with energy. The absence of norepinephrine begins to explain the psychomotor retardation of depression. It's exhausting to do everything. Serotonin has something to do with this rumination on grief, despair, guilt, and the shortage of dopamine has something to do with the anhedonia. Super simplistic. Okay, so we've now gotten a bit of a sense about the neurochemistry. Very quickly looking at something about the neuroanatomy of depression. We already know one thing, which is the hippocampus tends to get smaller. That's not what we'll focus on here. Instead, we hark back to many lectures ago, that triune brain concept. You've got that ancient reptilian brain that does mechanical regulatory stuff. You got the limbic system superimposed on top. And then you've got the cortex abstract thinking. Think for a second what a depression is about. Sad things, sad thoughts, sad memories, sad emotions. Go out and once again get gored by a rhino and you're going to turn on a stress response. You will secrete glucocorticoids. You will not feel like having sex all that much. Growth will probably be delayed. Sleep will be disrupted. Sit there instead and think about children in refugee camps. Think about childhood leukemia. Think about any of those things. And suddenly, your body does something similar to that with vegetative symptoms. Up go glucocorticoid levels, disruption of sleep, anhedonia, all of that. On a certain level then, what is a depression? A depression is when your cortex comes up with some abstract sad thoughts and manages to get the rest of your brain to go along with it as if it was a real stressor. What the cortex is about is the abstractions, the very, very subtle, poignant features of what stresses us, of what saddens us, of what depresses us, where it is then able to send projections down to those ancient reptilian areas, as we heard earlier, and stimulate them into a stress response. Okay, this is very simplistic, obviously. And now let's take this one step further with really an idiotically simplistic idea. Okay, so if the problem with depression is you got your cortex thinking, ooh, too many sad thoughts, and whispering it down to the reptilian part of the brain and kicking things into gear there, what's the cure for depression then? Take yourself a little pair of scissors and cut underneath the cortex and disconnect it from the rest of the brain. Oh, that's really a terrific therapy. That's really going to do a whole lot for you. Remarkably, a version of that which is used in very, very rare circumstances of severe intractable depression actually makes people feel a bit better. Something called a cingulum bundle cut. And that supports this notion of the cortex coming up with sad ideas. Okay, it's not just the cortex, it's a sub-area found very much intertwined with the frontal cortex, an area called the anterior cingulate. And the anterior cingulate comes up with the sad things. Watch your loved one being poked in their finger with a pin, the anterior cingulate activates. Have a sad thought with a sense of dread, it's the anterior cingulate, that's the area that is talking downstream. And what you find in depressives is overactivity of the anterior cingulate. That, in effect, in the super simplified way, that's the part of the cortex that's coming up with those sad, sad thoughts and getting the rest of the brain to go along with it. So where are we at right now? We've now come over the sort of basic symptoms of depression, and we've now looked quite a bit at the brain chemistry, the neurochemistry of it. We've just looked a little bit of the neuroanatomy of it. What we need to do next in the next lecture is look at some of the endocrinology of depression. What this should be screaming throughout all of this is a biological disorder. This is not stop indulging yourself. This is as biological as diabetes. There's something wrong with the brain chemistry, the brain structure, the sleep cycles, all of that. It's biology. But what we'll see in the next lecture is if all you do is think about the biology and not focus on the psychological aspects as well, you're not going to be in much of a position to help someone who is clinically depressed.
Lecture 20, Stress and the Psychology of Depression.
We return for the second lecture covering this disease of malignant sadness, depression, major clinical depression. And the previous lecture covered a number of things worth reviewing here. The first is emphasizing what an awful disease it is. 15% of us or so will have a major depression at some point in our lives, one of the leading causes of disability on the planet, and a paralyzing disease at an extreme. We saw something about the symptoms, most defining. It is a symptom, it is a disease of lack of pleasure, anhedonia, then elements of grief, of guilt, elements of what is termed psychomotor retardation. Everything is exhausting to do, to think, the possibilities of self-injury, those vegetative symptoms, including elevated glucocorticoid levels, and that really key point that comes out of vegetative symptomology in this disease, it's a disease. There are biological problems. This is not, oh, stop babying yourself. What we then shifted to is looking at some of the actual biology of the disease. And we started off with the neurochemistry, the famed norepinephrine hypothesis of depression, and how in the years since has given way to recognizing, yes, too little norepinephrine plays a role, likewise dopamine, likewise serotonin, interactions amongst them, and I would bet the farm that there's going to be a gazillion more neurotransmitters that are implicated. Then transitioning to structural features of the brain. And that key role played by the cortex, this area of the frontal cortex, the anterior cingulate, this part of the brain where you think abstract, sad thoughts, and in effect, get the rest of the brain to go along with it as if it were an actual stressor. So now we transition over to another piece of the biology story. What do hormones have to do with depression? And turns out a whole lot, not surprisingly. First realm is one that almost immediately comes to mind when you think about hormones and depression, which is the simple question, why do women have much higher rates of depression than men do? Now, there's two different types of depression. There's what's called unipolar depression, which is you alternate between being depressed and not depressed, depressed and not depressed. Then there's the much rarer, in some ways more disastrous, bipolar depression, manic depression, where you're oscillating around the extremes. Men and women have the same rates of bipolar. Women have roughly twice as much diagnoses of unipolar depression. So what's that about? All sorts of possibilities, all sorts of theories. One is the diagnostic criterion problem, which goes as follows. Men, when depressed, are more likely than women to self-medicate themselves with alcohol, with various drugs, and they're more likely to get labeled as an alcoholic than as a depressive. There's not actually a difference between men and women. It's just that a lot of the men get categorized in another way. Some evidence for this, not huge amounts. Next explanation for why, legitimately, women have higher rates of unipolar depression is a very sociological, almost anthropological one. As we know by now, lack of control plays a huge role in stress. And in this view, there's a focusing on the fact that in so many cultures across this planet, women traditionally have less control over their lives. And in this theory, it is setting up one more readily for depression. Another realm, and this one has to do with sort of emotional, psychological aspects, what people do with upsetting emotions. And the tendency that women are more likely than men on the average, that women are more likely than men to ruminate on disturbing problems. What do I mean by ruminate? And this is a realm where you do studies which, like, they're so embarrassing how cliched the results are, but how consistently they come out. You take someone who's just had an upsetting interaction with a friend, something like that, and you give them a choice of some things to do afterwards, certain questionnaire to fill out. And a huge percentage of women choose to fill out a questionnaire about the nature of their friendship, the person they just had the argument with, when they met, does the person have a good marriage, all that stuff. And like a huge percentage of the men choose to fill out some questionnaire, like trivia questions about the American presidency. No wonder these guys are such a mess. They can't communicate. They hide their emotions. On the average, once again, with obvious exceptions, on the average, women ruminate more on emotions, adverse emotions, than men do. That's pretty clear. What's much less clear is how rumination gets you into a higher rate of clinical depression. So all these sorts of possibilities, misdiagnosis, sociological explanations, emotive, communicative ones. For my money, the most interesting realm is, what do hormones have to do with depression? And what do hormones have to do with the predominance of depression in women? Now, part of what makes this very interesting, makes a sort of endocrine explanation very compelling to me, is it's not only the case that on the average women have higher rates of depression than men do, but the risk of depression in women tends to peak at certain times in life, certain times in one's life history, shortly after giving birth. The 2 weeks after birth, the postparturition period, is the most vulnerable time of life for a human to fall into a depression. Around the time of menopause, around the time of one's period, all of these are circumstances where there's very dramatic changes in levels of certain hormones. And you know by now what some of the most pertinent ones are. estrogen, progesterone. This is a realm where each has a lot of effects on the brain, remarkably where the ratio of the two have a lot of effects. And what we saw previously was all of these reproductive events from ovulation, menses, menopause, birth, involve enormous fluctuations in the levels of estrogen and progesterone, and thus potentially enormous fluctuations in the ratio of the two. And there's lots of reasons in my mind to think that abnormalities in levels of estrogen, levels of progesterone, levels of their ratio, levels of receptors for these in the brain may have something to do with this predominance of depression in women. And at this point, what's known is whatever your favorite theory is about the neurochemistry of depression, if you're a serotonin fan, if you're a dopamine one, if you're a norepinephrine, whichever one you are buying into, there's precedent for how estrogen and progesterone affects some aspect of that system. So that's the first hormone that's relevant. Next one that comes in, thyroid hormone. Thyroid hormone, extremely interesting, because what you see is thyroid hormone coming out of your thyroid gland, brain pituitary, what it plays a large role in is maintaining your metabolic rate. And what you see is when people become hypothyroid, a real drop in their levels of thyroid hormone in their metabolism, there's a greatly increased risk of falling into a depression. And in fact, what the numbers suggest is something like 15-20% of depressions out there are in fact not due to a primary depressive disorder, but are instead secondary to an undiagnosed hypothyroidism. So what we see here is this very important point, which should be obvious by now. You can't separate the brain from metabolism, from nutrition, intertwining of all of them. Now, for our purposes here, in this course in general, obviously the endocrine world that's most interesting with respect to depression is stress hormones, glucocorticoids. And as we've heard already, amid a tendency, somewhat of a tendency for elevated sympathetic nervous system tone in people with depression, there is a very reliable increase in glucocorticoid levels in about half of depressives and the ones with the most serious cases. So suddenly, we get pulled in explicitly for the first time something about the interactions between stress and depression. So what's the evidence to think there's even a link for this? The first is epidemiological. People who have just had major stressful events are now statistically more likely to fall into a depression. That's simply the pattern that you see. You see it with an interesting subtlety, which is, suppose you have somebody who has some awful, stressful event happen to them, and they fall into a depression, and they come out the other end. This person is no more at risk now for a subsequent depression than anybody else is. A second trauma comes along. They fall into a depression the second time. They recover. They come out the other end. They're still no more at risk for a subsequent depression. Somewhere around the fourth or fifth round of this, something happens and some endogenous process begins to take place and the person's depressions begin to cycle rhythmically, independent of whether something stressful occurs in the outside world. Enormously important to understand this transition. So epidemiologically, stressors are associated with increased risk of early stage depression. More evidence. People who are given very high levels of synthetic glucocorticoids for their autoimmune disorder, their inflammatory issues there, not only is there the possibility of the memory problems we've heard about, but you greatly increase the risk of somebody going into a depression. Early stage of treatment with steroids, corticosteroids, people tend to have a euphoria, be in this energized state. Very long-term treatment, increased risk of depression. Back to Cushing's syndrome. Cushing's disease, any of a number of tumors where the result is you are secreting enormous amounts of glucocorticoids, and Cushing's disease carries an increased risk of depression. Okay, possible confound here. Well, duh, of course you get depressed. You've got this awful endocrine disorder. What are the appropriate controls in studies like these? People who have equally severe disorders, but ones that happen not to involve an elevated glucocorticoids, and the Cushingoid folks have the higher levels of rates of depression. Now, all of this evidence linking glucocorticoids, elevated glucocorticoids, to depression has given rise to a fascinating potential new realm of depression therapeutics. As mentioned earlier, there are drugs that target the norepinephrine system, the dopamine system, serotonin, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. There's drugs that are being tried that target some of the neurochemistry of pain, remarkably, and they can decrease depression, psychic pain, using some of the same pathways as physical pain, all these different therapeutics. A new one that's emerging is the notion of knock down glucocorticoid levels, decrease glucocorticoid signaling, and maybe that will work as an antidepressant. And Alan Schatzberg, psychiatrist at Stanford University, has been pioneering some of the work of using these anti-glucocorticoids. Some decrease the release of glucocorticoids, others block glucocorticoid receptors. The net result is less glucocorticoid signaling. And when you look at depressives with some of the most extreme versions of psychotic depression, with some of the most dramatic elevations of glucocorticoid levels, anti-glucocorticoid therapy appears to be helpful and therapeutic. So we see here glucocorticoids intertwined pharmacologically, therapeutically,